Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, welcome to the Friday edition of The Realignment. As you all know, The Realignment's additional episodes on Fridays are brought to you by Realignment Supercast subscribers. Supercast is the way that we monetize the show. So if you want to go to realignment.supercast.com and not only support our show's mission, but also help us produce more, pay our staff, and level things up going into 2024, that election period, I would love for you once again to go to realignment.supercast.com. On to today's interview. I'm speaking with Tobias Harris. He is the author of The Iconoclast, Shinzo Abe, and The New Japan. This conversation is incredibly relevant on a couple different levels. Number one, former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was assassinated last month. I'm sure folks probably saw that in the news. So going over his biography, him being one of the most important Japanese prime ministers of the post-war era is just really relevant. Two, Japan is a country which, under Shinzo Abe's leadership, really started to reposition itself, how it conceived of itself, and how it approached foreign policy questions in the 21st century in a bunch of different ways, whether or not you agree with her current policy in Ukraine or whether you agree with the policy towards Taiwan and China. The U.S. is in the middle of a similar conversation. So looking at how another country approaches this sort of challenge is incredibly important. Finally, this is just a great conversation about the times we live in, because Shinzo Abe framed himself as a leader who was attempting to really reconcile himself with a world that was changing from the way it was before. So there's obviously a lot that we could take from that as Americans or any other country around the world. For that said, once again, thank you to our Supercast subscribers and a huge thank you to Lincoln Network, our sponsor. Hope you all enjoy this conversation. Tobias Harris, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me on, Marshall. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad to chat with you. Let's start with the meaty part. You've written on your really excellent Substack that we're going through a pivotal moment in the international system right now. Why is Japan, and understanding what's happening in Japan, key to understanding the next decade or two of the international system?
Well, as a lot of Japanese politicians have become fond of saying, Japan is a frontline state, you know, that if the long-term competition with China is the central geopolitical question of our time, Japan is there. It has its, the questions of territorial competition with China, the military balance with China, the overall direction of the economic order in Asia. And of course, you know, we know that East Asia is really the growth engine for the global economy. And all Japan is at the heart of resolving all of those issues. And how Japan changes itself domestically, how it changes its international relationships is really going to be central to how the confrontation or competition with China resolves itself. And Japan has taken, I think, something, I guess, a long time to wake up. I mean, to really see what change is happening and what it has to do to respond to that change. And we're starting to really see bigger questions being asked than we have, I think, for some time.
And we'll get into Shinzo Abe's biography a bit in a bit, but you have this good quote where you point out that in 2007, he gave a speech where he had this quote where he said, "My mission is none other than to draw a new vision of a nation that can withstand the raging waves of the next 50 to 100 years. So you're describing this future. We're talking about China, economic competition, resolving globalization. But to save Japan needed a new vision in 2007. So a long time ago, I think speaks to the longer term vision. Like, what was he seeing in 2007 when he's describing those 50 to 100 years?
Well, and, you know, again, we'll, I'm sure, get more in detail, but I mean, really, it was as much true about stretching back as it was looking forward. And that was, you know, looking back to Japan, defeated Japan in 1945, occupied Japan, and, you know, a Japan that was essentially shackled and prevented from being a great power and competing in the world as a great power. And he was looking ahead and saying, well, yeah, you know, China, you know, is only growing stronger. You know, of course, I think, you know, part of that is also questions about the United States and the staying power of the United States in Asia and sort of worries about that, you know, looking at a more competitive global economy and seeing that the constraints that Japan had inherited from the end of the war were making Japan less safe, you know, that the world around Japan was changing. And you know, looking ahead and seeing the kind of changes that we're reckoning with now. So, I mean, and, you know, and I think in some ways, one of the things Abe struggled with was that he perhaps saw those things more clearly than most earlier and was not necessarily a welcome prophet. You know, that a lot of people, you know, that his message was not necessarily well received. And we can get into some of the reasons, you know, for that and why he ended up being, you know, such a polarizing figure. But the fact is that not everyone necessarily saw the urgency or the need to change fundamental institutions in the way that he did. I can't hear you.
Let's get to the actual biography section then. Who was Shinzo Abe specifically? Obviously, folks are going to know about him in terms of the assassination last month, but what's the broader context on who he was?
So, you know, I always like to think of Abe as someone who really, from a very early point in his political career, was conscious of his place in history and of kind of the weight of history. You know, that he's someone, you know, the first, you know, his biography starts with the fact that he comes from a really prominent political family, you know, that his grandfather, Kishi Nobusuke, was not only a post-war prime minister, an important post-war prime minister, but of course was also a member of wartime cabinets, was a prominent economic planner during the sort of the pre-war wartime period. And so he inherited, I think, a sense of Japan's mission from his grandfather. I think, you know, in terms of his studying of his grandfather, in terms of getting kind of a leg up once he entered politics, of course, the fact that his father, Abe Shintaro, had been a long-serving foreign minister in the 1980s, was basically you know, on track to sooner or later become prime minister, but died prematurely. And so he had very much a political princeling, as you know, we'd like to talk about in Asia, you know, in different countries, you have these princelings, you know, who have you know, inherited their power and their authority from their prominent families. But I think really the important thing to note about Abe, it's not just that he comes from a prominent family, but he comes from a prominent family whose mission, as articulated by Kishi, was really undoing the reforms that were introduced after after the surrender and during the occupation, that, you know, that these restraints that were put on Japan, starting with the constitution, but a number of other reforms that Kishi felt made Japan weak and dependent on the United States. And this is not that it's not an anti-Americanism, but it was a kind of at times almost like a kind of Japanese Gaulism, you know, that Japan should be an autonomous great power, you know, should, you know, be in the ranks of the free world, but should do it on its own terms and should have its own, you know, a proper military, should be, you know, fully fledged great power. And so that was definitely a minority view and what was called an anti-mainstream view during the Cold War. And Abe inherited those views, updated them for a post-Cold War environment, and saw that there was a real window of opportunity. And that was really where he comes from. You know, inheriting this mission to change the post-war, what he called the post-war regime, and really make a stronger top-down Japanese state in a way that you hadn't seen after 1945.
Yeah, and could you lay it out really directly? Like, what were the post-World War II specific limitations that were placed in Japan? I think folks probably think of the military. It's called the, you know, self-defense force for a reason. Like, what is the broad structure that was, I was about to say imposed, but to, I mean, I guess the other question there too is, like, to what degree is that just a imposition from the top, but also a bottom up, hey, like, we actually agree that these limits are reasonable and make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you raised the latter point, because it's actually, I mean, it's really important that, yes, there's a sense that at least from the beginning, you know, these The occupation's goals of democracy and demilitarization were imposed, but there were plenty of Japanese who essentially indigenized those reforms, who accepted them as important. And in some ways, underlying a lot of that was a suspicion of centralized power, you know, and not understandably, right? I mean, you had this militarist regime, and you almost got something of an informal pact at times. I mean, sometimes maybe even almost a more formal pact, but between kind of the left wing, which had been, of course, oppressed and basically all thrown in jail by the militarist regime and found themselves released during the occupation. And then, of course, sort of kind of conservatives who had been more inclined to Britain and the United States, and you know, so we're sort of anti-war conservatives during the imperial, the pre-1945 period. A lot of these figures then end up in positions of power, you know, after the war, during the occupation, then when the occupation ends, and you know, so they essentially united to kind of lock in some of the occupation reforms. So starting with the Constitution in Article 9, by which Japan, the language is, basically gives up on using force as an instrument for settling international disputes. Of course, you end up getting an armed force within a couple of years after the end of the occupation, the self-defense forces. But that you had a suspicion of centralized power. So you had restrictions sort of on the strength of the central government. Lots of emphasis on civilian control of the military, and the military not just being limited in the roles it could play, but almost like being limited in its presence in society and in politics. I mean, just a very as some political scientists have called this, an anti-militarist approach to the self-defense forces. So that was sort of this ethos, and you had Prime Minister Yoshida, who was prime minister during the occupation and just afterwards, basically articulated what became known as the Yoshida Doctrine, which was that Japan would be lightly armed, would be closely allied to the United States, even if it meant essentially being dependent on the United States and being an unsinkable aircraft carrier for the United States. And it would focus on economic development and reconstruction, and it would sort of be content with that, that it was not, it would not be pursuing this path of we're going to become a great power again. It was, we're going to sort of accept our place as a dependency of the United States, because getting, rebuilding our economy and rebuilding society is more important. And so all of that whole mix, and you add to that sort of liberalizing reforms that change the education system to make it more bottom up, which, the right wing really came to dislike, you just add that all up, and it was not the society that the right wing wanted. They just felt that this was an unjust imposition. It was as much a lot of their ire was not necessarily at the United States. A lot of it was at the domestic partners of the United States who accepted this, who wanted it brought into Japan and protected these institutions and allowed them to sort of sink in roots domestically. Where I mean, really, they became. The Japanese people became quite attached to them. And so that was, by the time you get to the 1990s, people like Abe, like this sort of young generation of conservatives, I mean, this is as much aimed at an older generation of kind of LDP officials who had sort of accepted these institutions and this way of governing Japan as, I mean, they were also, of course, angered at the left, but, the nearer enemy was within the LDP and saying, we need to change the LDP entirely and make it a much more kind of ideologically cohesive party that's committed to, removing some of these post-war institutions.
And I'm curious, let's focus on the broad picture aside from the specifics of it. Where do you come down on the debate of how much does Japan have to change in response to, let's say, the post-Cold War 21st century environment?
I think you look back at how Japan's government worked during the Cold War, and I think institutions that made sense at the time. You had when Japan was growing, double-digit growth, and maybe the main political challenge was how do we ensure equity in the distribution of the fruits of those growth, and you essentially had the LDP evolve as an institution geared to doing that, to ensuring that sort of those gains were distributed. Clearly, by the early 1990s, that was not going to be good enough anymore. And, you know, the list of challenges, you know, the fact that you had a much more fluid international environment that required, I think, much more nimble foreign policy making that, you know, the old apparatus wasn't quite capable of. The economic challenges, of course, you know, the bursting of the bubble, the long-term stagnation, the just the challenges posed by the demographic outlook, all of that was going to require a lot more creative, decisive policymaking than you were going to get. And the fact is that this was actually consensus in the Japanese political system for a long time. I mean, the 90s and 2000s, you know, this was not, I mean, Abe, I think, was ended up being an important protagonist of this view, but he was far from the only one. And you look, you know, 2009, the Democratic Party of Japan, you know, sweeps the LDP out of power, becomes the first non-LDP party to win a majority in the Diet, you know, since the LDP had formed in 1955. And their platform was, we need political control, we need decisive government, we need top-down leadership, you know, we need to limit the power of the bureaucracy, you know, we need government that can make decisions. So this, I mean, there was a consensus that this was that Japan actually did have to change in this direction, that you know, essentially that things had been kind of easy during the Cold War because, you know, foreign policy was predictable, economic growth, you know, created a certain amount of predictability. But the fact is that, you know, post Cold War international and domestic environments were just less predictable and required just stronger leadership and government that could react and be creative in ways that you just did not see during the Cold War. And so I suspect that in some form that kind of reform was necessary. You know, whether it was specifically the form Abe took it, you know, is a different question. But in general, that thrust, you know, I think was an appropriate response to the conditions of the last few decades.
And something I'm curious about, could you talk a bit about how Japanese society and the debate we're describing really reacted to the post-1990s economic slowdown? Because it seems to me, if you're, let's say, a Japanese leader in the 1980s, you've got just like this perfect situation. You've got this consensus around the military. You have this really economically dominant resurgence. Like, go back and read any foreign policy book in the 1980s. And in many ways, like, there's, you know, all the obvious references about, you know, Japanese businessmen and conglomerations buying up various like icons in New York City. You're getting a point of cultural dominance whether you're talking about real serious cultural exports. So you just got the perfect, just keep up, keep up, keep up, keep up. We're good to go. But the 90s, separate from the Cold War ending, and maybe it's not separate, that obviously goes away. Like, how was that felt within Japan specifically?
I mean, it's you know, I like to think of it as what happened. You know, there's this debate you see that pops up from time to time, you know, why haven't we seen populism in Japan? You know, why is Japan this island where there's not this sort of populist politics? But the fact is, in the 90s and 2000s, you did have at least a flavor of populist politics. You did have, you know, this sort of, you know, if at its heart, populism is about kind of naming your enemies and sort of dividing into us and them and, you know, who do we need? Who are the bums who need to be kicked out? There was a lot of that in the 90s and 2000s. You know, a lot of this was, you know, and aimed at the LDP's old guard in different ways, you know, that, you know, that, you know, particularly.
The LDP is that's the conservative.
Yeah. Party. So the Liberal Democratic Party, you know, the dominant party, you know, governed Japan for all but about 4 years since 1955. But again, you know, they had overseen high speed growth and then also had built this machine essentially for distributing gains, you know, to poorer parts of the country, you know, protecting declining industries, basically, you know, taking the fruits of, you know, these world beating global companies, you know, and the growth they produced and shifting it around often to politically important constituencies. You know, a lot of people looked at that and said, you know, that this is holding us back. You know, it's sort of populism that was sort of flipped on its head. You know, it was sort of in a lot of ways, it actually ended up being kind of a neoliberal populism, you know, aimed at urban voters. You know, look, you know, they're making your food cost more and they're, you know, protecting farmers and they're, you know, shoveling money to construction industries in rural areas. And, you know, it means you're not getting the benefits of, you know, you're paying taxes, you know, to pay for all of this. And, you know, we're going to try to improve your quality of life. And so it was sort of appealing to urban voters against sort of the LDP's more rural base. And, you know, of course, you had tremendous malapportionment that gave, you know, rural constituencies more power. And so a lot of the populism you saw in the 90s and 2000s was competing for sort of urban floating voters, doing these appeals, you know, to try to kick out the LDP's old guard. I mean, even within the LDP. So you have, perhaps the greatest populist politician Japan has produced, Junichiro Koizumi in the early 2000s, whose central message was promising to destroy his own party, which is like such a bizarre thing, but it almost like a classic populism kind of thing, right? It's almost the answer to like people in the United States talking about rhinos, right? You know, that they're not defenders of the true interests of the party, and we've got to kick them out and change how power works within the party. And so there was plenty of populism, and that was, I think, one of the responses I think to the stagnation that you saw. And when we talk, that it wasn't just slowing growth, it was the suicide rate spiking, it was unemployment rising, to levels, that most countries would be envious of, but higher than Japan had seen in a long time. You had, if businesses didn't fail, they were sort of being kept alive, by lifelines of these, bad debts. I mean, it was just, a real sense that, stagnation as a kind of cultural malaise, almost, not, not just, something in the economic numbers, watching, decades old or longer institutions go bankrupt or collapse, tremendous corruption scandals that show that institutions weren't working anymore. And, to bring it back to Abe, I mean, this is really showing kind of the environment where he really made his political name, the sense of, these institutions really have failed the Japanese people in some fundamental way. And so there were several different responses to it. And his, I think, ended up triumphing over some of the competitors. But throughout Japanese politics, there was a sense of, we have to deal with the fact that our institutions aren't doing the job anymore.
Another phrase you used in your post-assassination writing is you described him, actually, I don't know if this was after the assassination, but you described him as fundamentally being a 19th century man in the 21st century. I'd love to just hear what you mean by that.
Sure. Of course, you look at modern Japanese history, and there's maybe no more important event in Japan's history, let alone world history, than the Meiji Restoration, right? You have this response, really, in some ways, almost the only successful response of a non-Western power to the advance of Western imperialism, of an Asian country copying the institutions of European and American countries.
Sorry, can we pause and like zoom back like
two centuries
then? So just basically take us from the 1600s, and then take us into the 1860s.
Okay, well, we're gonna go really far back.
Just for the broad context.
Yeah, sure. No, so Japan, after number of years of civil war and fighting between competing clans, you end up with one clan prevailing. So the Tokugawa win the civil war. They see the challenges that Japan was facing, including at that point the arrival of European missionaries who had some success in converting Japanese, and particularly in the Southwest. And their response is essentially to close the country off. Now, it wasn't a 100% perfect sealing off of Japan, as it's sometimes characterized. But I mean, the fact is that the country, you had a trickle of foreign trade, intercourse, intellectual engagement, travel, visiting foreigners, all of that was sharply reduced. And for 250 years, essentially, that was the policy. Japan was closed off to the world. But by the mid-19th century, you have the European empires starting to carve up China. You have, the first Opium War. And you had a number of Japanese intellectuals and younger samurai who were looking at the government's response to the approach of European empires in the United States, you know, particularly after, of course, Commodore Perry arrives in 1853 with his ultimatum. And there was a belief that the government, the Tokugawa government, was no longer up to the task. You know, that again, you had these tremendous challenges, again, sounding very similar to what we've already talked about, kind of in the discourse around the challenges Japan faces today, and sort of this belief that you had to really had to change the government fundamentally to enable Japan to defend itself from these European empires, you know, to defend itself from the United States, to ensure that Japan remained independent. And so, of course, by 1867, 1868, you have another civil war. The Tokugawa basically, Tokugawa resistance collapses, and you end up with these ambitious young samurai from Western Japan who changed the government and put, you know, they say they were restoring the emperor, but in practice it was sort of government by, you know, sort of this class of elites. And where it's relevant for Abe is that they come, one of the most important places that resisted Tokugawa rule and was seeking a change of the ruling regime was a clan or a domain named Choshu at the western end of Honshu, the main island. And that domain today is Yamaguchi Prefecture, which is, of course, where Abe and his family are from and where Abe's seat in the Diet is. And so Abe is a politician, his political identity, you know, of course, all Japanese politicians like to talk about the restoration and talk about opening and talking about the importance of that moment. I mean, it's just, you know, in maybe in the same way that Americans like to talk about the founding or think, you know, that this is, you know, a seminal political moment that lots of different political figures like to try to use. But of course, because of the geographical connection, there's a particular attachment, I think, for Abe, you know, that he thinks about, you know, the role played by the young samurai of Choshu and throwing off the Tokugawa regime and doing what was necessary to make a modern state that could defend Japan in a dangerous world. And so there's, you know, there's that geographic component. And the thing, you know, to bring it back to his grandfather, Kishi, his grandfather was born in 1894. I want to say 1895, but I think it's 1894. So, you know, he's, you know, a product of this generation that was coming of age at sort of the height of the Meiji period. So Emperor Meiji dies in 1912. But, you know, this is a period where Japan fights its first war, you know, fights a war against China, then fights a war against Russia victoriously and sort of, you know, admired throughout the world for its martial prowess, you know, defeating a European empire. You know, he looked at his grandfather's generation, you know, the generation that grew up during sort of the heights of Meiji achievement. And he, you know, he writes about this, you know, early in his career about admiring that generation, admiring its confidence. I think the other piece of sort of the 19th century mind that I think you see in Abe is, you know, fundamentally as someone, you know, I think he looks at the world and sees a world of a kind of a competition between nations, between peoples, you know, in a very 19th century way of thinking, you know, that, you know, this is not someone who thinks the nation state is dead. You know, this is not someone who thinks, you know, that, you know, borders have been dissolved. You know, this is still very much, you know, the world, you know, the international system essentially pits peoples against each other. And countries have to do what they need to survive in that competition. And states have to do what they need to do to survive in that competition. And I think it's just a very 19th century way of thinking about things. You know, again, a very Meiji period way of thinking about things. And so at some level, you know, sort of neo-Meijiism, you know, bringing that response to the challenges Japan faced in the 19th century, bringing that thinking forward into the 21st century.
Man, a bunch of things to say to that. Number one, we'll just, you know, let you answer each one and go down the line. Number one would basically be, do you think that 19th century mindset was a strength or a weakness? Because if we were recording this in the 1990s, let's say the height of Thomas Friedmanism, this would almost certainly be very pejorative, or most listeners would probably hear that and say, wow, like that's something we left behind. This doesn't really feed into what technology is happening, globalization's occurring. So just everything that's being, if basically at an analytical level, you'd probably question that model of thinking of the world. So then sitting in the world of 2022, like, is a 19th century mindset a strength or a weakness?
I mean, I think when you look at Asia and Northeast Asia, in some ways it's a rational response. I mean, you have, China is thinking in much the same way, and, you know, looks, you know, it is very much, you know, the, you know, it is a state that is expanding in ways that would not be unfamiliar in the 19th century, you know, in all of the tools it's using, right? Both the sort of economic, kind of it's expanding economic influence, you know, but also exploring gumboat diplomacy and overseas. I mean, it's acting in a way, you know, that great powers in the past have behaved. And so that's a response. I mean, I think both Koreas in their own ways think of the world in similar ways. I mean, it's still a world that I think is still very much competition between nation states. You know, this is not, this is not, you know, the EU, right? This is not, you know, they're not reinventing regional governance. I mean, this is still a world of nation states competing with each other for power and influence. And so, in some ways, what Abe is doing is also just trying to convince his fellow Japanese to, you know, that Japan can't sit this out, that this is the world they live in, this is the region they live in, and, you know, that to pretend otherwise would put, you know, Japanese lives and prosperity at risk ultimately. I mean, I think that was ultimately the case he was trying to make to the Japanese people, that that our neighbors are thinking like this, so we can't afford not to. We can't afford to not do whatever it takes to defend ourselves. And also, I mean, just in terms of economic competition, because a lot of, you know, for every country in Asia, a lot of this is just finding ways to get an edge. You know, whether it's market share and sort of the advanced technologies of the future. Cost reductions, figuring out where you fit in supply chains, whatever dimension of economic competition we want to talk about. I mean, this is the world Japan finds itself in, and I think just so fundamentally that kind of lens of competition between nation states, is something that Abe was trying to do, and I think it's taken time for Japanese to come around to it. It's not exactly something that everyone was happy with. You know, of course, you know, many just didn't, you know, why couldn't we continue on as we did during the Cold War? Why do we have to, you know, why does Japan have to compete for power and influence? Why can't we sit it out? And, you know, that, you know, fundamentally is, I think, in some ways the source of, you know, Abe as a controversial figure domestically. You just had a lot of people who just did not actually buy his argument that Japan had to enter the competition.
So I want you to put your analyst hat on and give folks some advice. You've described how the Asia-Pacific region is one which fits many 19th century conditions. The vast majority of folks, and I think this is what distinguishes most people from, you know, Shinzo Abe, obviously, are not 19th century leaders. They're 21st century leaders. How do you think 21st century leaders should respond to 19th century conditions?
You know, I think fundamentally, and again, I think this is something that Abe was very good at. You know, it would suggest that being overly focused on ideology is not actually the right idea, that, you know, that fundamentally that flexibility is more important, you know, and that you know, if it is a competition between nation states, and particularly if it's about a competition for influence with, you know, a potential rival hegemon within the region, the goal ultimately needs to be, you know, what can the United States do to protect the independence of small countries around China, or smaller countries around China. And so that's not an ideological struggle, right? You know, that if we're talking with Vietnam, and, you know, how do we safeguard Vietnam's kind of national independence, and avoiding become helping Vietnam not be overly dependent on China economically or politically, that's not a clash of ideologies. That's a, you know, we're dealing with a world where, ensuring the independence of, of nation states is the goal, rather than advancing, liberalism, advancing democracy. And you know, we've, of course, in the last couple of years, you know, there's been lots of talk about, you know, the rules-based international order, and you know, that is the goal. And of course, under the Biden administration, lots of talk about democracy versus authoritarianism. But the fact is that I think we just have to be clear-eyed on what the competition is about. And, you know, yes, there's, you know, an element of, you know, competing against a type of authoritarianism and sort of a modern, you know, updated authoritarianism. But in Asia, that's not necessarily what you're dealing with. I mean, you are dealing with almost national independence and safeguarding sort of the freedom of maneuver for countries in Southeast Asia, for sort of the smaller countries of the region, and trying to prevent them from being dominated by their larger neighbor, whether or not those countries are democracies. I mean, if we can help them become democracies, great. But fundamentally, I think that's more the nature of the competition. And it's something that I think, you know, as Prime Minister Abe, I think was very clear-eyed about. You know, yes, occasionally, you talked about, you know, through the Quad, strengthening cooperation with the region's democracies. But it was never about advancing democracy. It was about, you know, okay, these countries, you know, sort of the maritime powers of Asia who happen to be democracies working together, to preserve national independence, preserve the autonomy of these countries, you know, ensuring that you have a regional economic order that works for everyone. All of that was the goal, which was not necessarily, you know, exactly coinciding with this framing of democracy versus authoritarianism. So it does require, I think, a bit of nuance in thinking about what exactly is the nature of the competition in the region. What exactly should our goals be? What exactly is what's a realistic goal? And I think, again, I think that's in some ways what this framing gets to more, that, you know, our ability to advance democracy or even prevent democratic backsliding, say in, you know, Thailand or the Philippines, you know, other regional democracies, is actually pretty limited. And if that's the case, you know, what is the more realistic goal? What should we be doing when we're, you know, sort of marshaling our alliances in the region? What's within our power? And, you know, if we're thinking about national independence, national autonomy, that's a much more attainable goal in some ways than sort of a more expansive liberalizing mission in the region, so to speak.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you're describing the objective as national independence versus pure autocracy versus democracy, you know, I frankly like the autocracy versus democracy language as like a top, as a organizing framework, because I think it usefully explains the quote unquote stakes in a way that isn't just very, you know, bloodless. But to your point, if we're talking about autocracy and democracy and, you know, liberalism, the Philippines doesn't really put you in the most convenient position to explain that. So it's easier, not even just easier in the sense of like you're taking the easy way out, but it's actually just much straightforward to say, look, at a broad level, it's national independence. So something, one more question that I'll ask before we get to the last bit of this show is, I'm really interested by you describing Shinzo Abe as inspired by his grandfather's generation's confidence. I'm really interested in the topic of confidence because I think a critique you can make of Western leaders broadly is that there's a large lack of confidence in response to basically the post-Cold War moment. However, it seems that the confidence of his grandfather's generation led to just utter disaster. So utter disaster. You know, you've got the real height of the Russo-Japanese War, but, you know, Japan doesn't really get a fair shake post-World War One, and everything from then on seems just, it's not just seems, everything then on leads to the destruction of like the emperor in terms of the way it was conceived of, occupation. If the whole purpose of the isolationist policy was to preserve Japan's autonomy, well, the opposite policy of engagement with the world obviously led to the exact opposite of that achievement. So how do they really reckon with the confidence of that generation leading to disaster?
Well, you put your finger on a big problem and one of, you know, the most challenging parts of Abe's biography, that, you know, that one of the things he wanted to do was downplay those, you know, the consequences of that, and really talk about the good things that Imperial Japan did in Asia and how it helped defeat European empires and end European colonialism, and of course talk about how Japan wasn't at least exclusively responsible for the war, that it was encircled and provoked into war by the economic embargo the United States imposed and so on. It was a real problem with Abe as a politician, it's important to stress that I think when we talk about Abe as a revisionist, as an historical revisionist, I mean, I think it's important to understand that this wasn't an academic exercise. It wasn't simply, we need to get to the bottom, the truth of matters. It was about kind of how the instrumental uses of history. It was, part of his political project that if Japan was going to resume its pursuit of a place in the sun, if it was going to be a great power again, the people had to be confident and proud of their country. And it was this belief that by emphasizing all the bad things Japan had done, Japanese people were taught not to have pride in their country, and therefore no one would be willing to sacrifice on behalf of their country, and no one would be willing to take up arms on behalf of their country, and that had to be dealt with. And unfortunately, the approach to getting Japanese people to feel pride in their history was, essentially either denying or downplaying or quibbling about the number of people who were killed in Nanjing, or, all of that. It's really a tragedy in some ways that this was the mechanism they chose to do it. And it also meant at a number of different points, fighting with the United States, and fighting with the Bush administration. I mean, the Bush administration was not happy when Abe decided to make a point of quibbling about, were comfort women actually, conscripted or forcibly recruited for their roles. I mean, this was, a lot of Republicans on the Hill were not happy about this. So, even just as a, just thinking tactically and strategically, it was a total, almost a complete strategic mistake on Abe's part to continue pursuing this line of argumentation. I mean, so that was part of him as a politician. I think it was misguided. I think it made things more difficult with the United States. It made things more difficult with Japan's neighbors, and in some ways, totally unnecessary. Japan is admired in so many ways across the region. And as I think the Obama administration in particular was particularly concerned about, that this kept giving, Beijing a gift, right? That every time Abe, talked about this, it allowed China to talk about, Japan making excuses for its militarism. And, it allowed China to drive a wedge between South Korea and Japan instead of the two countries finding a way to get along. And so, as a strategic, just thinking strictly strategic terms, I mean, it was a real mistake on Abe's part.
What I like about the way you describe this is I've never, and once again, this is me just not doing enough background reading about Japan. I'd never really heard the articulation of where he started, which then led him to ending up with quibbling around, comfort women and visiting the war shrines and those bits. But I think he was responding to something which is real. So I think an example of this, and I deal with more, I deal with audiences that are like super engaged with foreign policy, like every once in a while. So like during the start of the war in Ukraine, I think an example of the dynamic that Shinzo Abe is speaking to is this idea of, well, the U.S. invaded Iraq, so who are we to care what happens in Ukraine? That is how, like, this example of, mm-hmm. I think there's a real danger of taking, let me put it this way, and once again, this goes to why I think you articulated this the right way. I don't need to say, well, did this many Iraqis really die? And well, actually, I'm going to publish a book like talking about how Saddam Hussein was like really terrible. I think it's possible to try to get folks to respond to issues and dangers in the present without having to both overemphasize the past in the present and also not make his mistake of quibbling with the numbers. That's not quite coherent because it's difficult to talk about it. But I think that's just the point of sympathy I have with him, because I think it would be very unhelpful to talk about how Japan should respond to a rising China and questions of Japan and questions over Taiwan with, well, you know, in 1938, we did X. Therefore, who are we to say this or that? Like that, I think that would be, that's the definition of unproductive. Like, how do you think about this dilemma?
You know, I think the problem is that also too often when, you know, it's this marriage of wanting to downplay what Imperial Japan did, and then also talk about let's get rid of the post-war regime, you know, and that. I think is what made certainly a lot of Japanese uncomfortable, and, you know, to say nothing of Japan's neighbors and certainly in China and Korea. It's that combination, I think, you know, really, I think is what drove a lot of the domestic opposition to what Abe wanted. Because it wasn't just, you know, the post-war regime served its purpose, but the institutions need to be updated. But I think rightly or wrongly, people said, well, he also wants to go back to, you know, Japan pre-1945. And that, I think, made a lot of Japanese uncomfortable. And I think there was certainly, and he did this at times. He sort of gradually got to this point. Mm-hmm. But because of things he said earlier in his career, I think it was never quite viewed as sort of his sincere expressions, as opposed to something he kind of grudgingly came to. But he, by 2015, 2016, you know, I think he finally recognized, well, you know what, the fact that Japan, has Article 9, the fact that it did have this anti-militarist identity, that it did actually seem to take seriously some of the lessons of the path to war that Imperial Japan went down, that it actually has a lot of legitimacy, you know, that if it wants to talk about actually like we know where this road leads, we don't want to see this again. We don't want to see Asia go to war again. And, you know, if that means, you know, begrudgingly, we have to prepare for our own defenses in ways, and we have to, you know, join forces with the United States and other allies to try to ensure that that there's not sort of dangerous military imbalances that invite aggression. But he could use post-war Japan as more of an asset, you know, as part of Japan's soft power, so to speak, something that makes Japan actually give Japan a lot of credibility, and you know, makes Japan a country, you know, that a lot of countries respect and listen to. And it could use historical reckoning as an asset. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that's where the strategic mistake comes in, that I think, you know, Article 9, because Article 9 hasn't necessarily restricted Japan from having a quite capable military.
And Article 9 is it technically?
It's you know, so it's the clause of the Constitution that, you know, Japan says it's not going to engage in war as an instrument of national policy, and won't maintain, basically it became interpreted as saying Japan won't maintain aggressive arms, you know, and military capacity. So that could still be that's something that could actually be an asset. Instead of rushing to revise the Constitution or talk about how, you know, the post-war regime is bad, I mean, that it's very easy to conceive of a way in which Japan uses that, you know, to be the champion of a cause, you know, that basically we don't want to see war in Asia. We know where that leads. We know where sort of unbridled aggression and expansionism can lead. And, you know, we think it's incumbent on all countries in Asia to, you know, of course, you know, pursue peace, but also that, you know, if necessary, you know, ensure that there's a military balance, you know, and we don't pursue military strength for conquest, but, you know, to do our part to safeguard, you know, a balance of power that favors peace. I mean, and that is a way that Japan could use history in a constructive way. And I think that too often, you know, the sort of this short-sighted focus on what do we need to do to make Japanese proud of their country squandered that, essentially. Mm-hmm. You know, that it alienated neighbors and alienated the United States, you know, in ways that were actually quite counterproductive. and just totally unnecessary. Just like it did not. I don't think it. Necessarily,
I don't think it increased Japanese patriotism.
No, I don't. Yeah, no, exactly. I don't think it. I don't actually think it raised, Japanese pride in any sort of noticeable way, and it made. To the extent that Abe was controversial, it was because of stuff like this, that people just didn't trust him. And so when he talked about Japan being more prominent and playing a greater role in providing security to the region, well, that looked suspicious to people, because while he had this history of saying, things about the wartime past, and look, I don't think Abe was preparing, for Japan to engage in wars of conquest. And, he was still a very cautious politician, for all of the things he wanted to achieve, was careful not to run too far ahead of public opinion. And, so this is not someone who, there's a scholar, Robert Jajarik, who at some point during Abe's government described Abe as a sheep in wolf's clothing, that sort of like talked about all this, military power and talked about the imperial past. But when it came down to it, did not actually go quite as far as you would think from the rhetoric. And there's definitely something to be said for that. But again, I mean, if we're looking at sort of strategic, history as a strategic tool, I mean, it was greatly mishandled, I think, by Abe and a number of his ideological compatriots.
So for the last question that I'm sure everyone is wondering right now, obviously there's a lot of deep interested focus on Taiwan and China's rise and if that conflict will escalate. How do you see Japan playing into the conversation around deterrence, escalation, those different bits? Like, how should we, if there's another Taiwan crisis, if there's another incident, how should we think of Japan, this post Shinzo Abe Japan, fitting into that framework? So you don't have to give a prediction, that's not helpful, but just as a framework perspective, should we think, okay, how is Japan seeing that?
So I think the thing to note certainly about this year and this moment is that the Ukraine crisis in some ways did more, or seemingly has done more, to shift Japanese public opinion on defense matters than years of agitation by people like Abe. I think there was something about watching basically naked aggression against a European country, watching Ukrainians huddling in the Kyiv subway. I think there was something about the visuals of that that really, I think, were a wake-up call. I mean, there was really something about that that seems to have triggered a real shift in Japanese public opinion. So if you look at the last 5 months or so of polling on this question of how much should Japan spend on defense, for the first time, as far as I know, I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a poll to suggest otherwise, that the public is a majority is actually consistently majorities are now shown as being in favor of increasing defense spending. Which, this was a country that until Abe returned to power in 2012 had cut its defense budgets for a decade. And the increase, Abe reversed that, but their increases have generally been small because the public is not necessarily clamoring for it. There definitely seems to be a shift in terms of, Japan actually needs to be more prepared, needs to be more willing to spend on its own defense. I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions about what that will mean in practice, just how big the increases end up being, what it ends up spending those increases on. There's sort of been a tendency in the past when you've had defense spending increases to kind of buy flashy big ticket items. But in some ways, I think the lesson of Ukraine is actually stockpiling like munitions and missiles and anti-armor and anti-ship missiles and all of that. It might go further as a defensive matter than some flashier, fighters or things like that. So there's still that question. There's still a big debate about how Japan's going to pay for it. And there's a lot of, this debate was very active earlier this year. Abe was a major player in that. Not clear who's going to kind of fill his shoes advocating for bigger spending increases and less quibbling about how to pay for it. there's at least still a pretty active debate going on right now about whether Japan should acquire the capability and allow itself to strike back against targets in foreign countries, a capability that basically they've never really had. And we might get a decision on that in the next several months. And so all of this is pointing to Japan going further than we've seen before. And we've seen incremental change. Japan has been moving in the direction of becoming a more, just a more capable, more active military power. But in terms of spending, in terms of the role it's going to, roles it's prepared to play, there might be, we might really be at a turning point where you see some decisions made that really enable Japan to be active in its own defense and in regional defense in ways that it hasn't before. And so that's, you know, we'll see in the next kind of 6 months where some of these debates play out. They're working on updating a number of core national security documents. And that's really going to be the thing to watch through the end of the year.
That is an excellent place to leave it. Tobias, would love for you to shout out the Substack, the book, obviously, which I'm sure is just, it must be weird having written this book. I'm sure you didn't expect this to be just like this was not, like you said, it's not like an authorized biography. It's analytical, but I think for most folks, if you hop on Amazon, you know, that's how I found your book. That's probably how it's going to be for folks. So yeah, shout out the Substack, the book, all those great things, and we'll take it from here.
Yeah, sure. So the Substack is Observing Japan, which is the Substack version of a blog that I started years ago, just writing about Japanese politics. And the book is The Iconoclast, Shinzo Abe and the New Japan from Hearst. And yeah, be grateful if you gave it a read.
Great. Thanks for joining us on The Realignment.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.